Hey, this is local recording artist Bex, and you're listening to CFCR 90.5 FM.
Look down, and you'd hug yourself on the cold, cold ground. You wake the morning in a stranger's coat, but no one would you see. You ask yourself, who'd watch for me? My only friend, who could it be? It's hard to say it, I hate to say it, but it's probably me. When your belly's empty and the hunger's so real, you're too proud to beg and too dumb to steal. You search the city for your only friend, but no one will you see. Ask yourself, who'd watch for me? A solitary voice to speak out and set me free. I hate to say it, I hate to say it, but it's probably me. You're not the easiest person I ever got to know. It was hard for us both. That I feel unsure. Some would say I should let you go your way. You only make me cry. But if there's one guy, just one guy, who laid down his life for you and I, I hate to say it, I hate to say it, but it's probably me.
Just after the bottom of the midnight hour in Saskatoon, you are listening to Saskatchewan's most popular and most listened to overnight radio broadcast. Of course, it's a stand-up sit-down, but you didn't need me to tell you that, but I just did, because I'm trying to make you smarter. This is Trevor Dean on CFCR, Saskatoon's community radio station, 90.5 FM. Of course, the stand-up sit-down is the show where we peel back the layers of stand-up comedy, much like we peel back the layers of an onion without the mental illness, addictions, or restraining orders, which is a good thing. But then it takes all the fun out of a comedian's life. So what are you supposed to do? Of course, a number of ways that you can listen to us tonight. If you are in the Saskatoon area, 90.5 in the FM dial, on Sasktel Max Channel 820, on the website at cfcr.ca, or the mobile app available for Apple and Android products. This is show number 31. You think I'd have all this down, but when you're here by yourself, it gets lonely, and sometimes my mind just wanders. But we won't talk about that, because that's for another show. We do have new listeners tonight from Chicago, Illinois. We will get into that in a minute. It's probably the only time they'll ever listen, because they're actually on the show, which kind of makes sense. Don't forget that CFCR has a winter getaway contest where you can win a WestJet travel voucher for $1,000. And if you happen to be a CFCR member who wins, you get an extra $500 cash. Go to the website cfcr.ca or check out their various social media channels on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter to find out more information about how you can win the contest And I believe, yeah, it says contest closes January 30th. I got the lights off in the studio for some reason, and I'm like squinting, which is, yeah, I know. Good job, Trev. Thanks, I know. Of course, we do have the website for the show too, which is the standupsitdownshow.com. Go on there anytime. You can listen to all of the previous episodes, promos, find out about the show, and all that kind of stuff. And there is a link on the website to the CFCR website where you can listen anytime. Although we prefer that if you're going to the show's website and you're going to click on the link, it's probably because you'd want to listen to the show. At least I'm assuming. Not that I try to assume, because, you know, assuming makes an ass out of you and me. Anyways, what else can I tell you? I guess there's one more thing, too. We have, oh yeah, that's right. We have guests lined up for the next 2 weeks. Hot diggity, I know. Next week, we will have Rachel Summer, who's now based out of Australia. She is Canada's funniest optometrist. She is a full-time optometrist and a stand-up comedian. She's got a YouTube video from the Winnipeg Comedy Festival. Just crushes 5 minutes on optometry. And we will put that up at the beginning of next week. And the week after that, we have a guest that admittedly I don't know anything about. And I'm not afraid to say I don't know, because that's just the way I am. He's a gentleman that one of our previous guests, Brian Cox, steered me towards. He's a comedian out of LA named Steve Bluestein. And he's got a new book out that he wants to promote and talk about. His first book, I did a little bit of research. His first book was called Take My Prostate, Please, which chronicles his going through prostate cancer treatments. So he sounds like he's an interesting story. And he will be 2 weeks down the road. Next week will be Rachel Holman. And yes, we have a whole bunch of comedians that have said via Twitter that they will be on the show. And now they're avoiding me. They're just liking my tweets. People like Tammy Pescatelli, Tom Green, Lars Callio. Who else? Andrew Gross. Although he said that he'll come to Saskatoon next time he's here and do the show. Cop comic Jim Perry. He's based out of the States. Used to be a law enforcement officer. Then he retired. Now he's doing stand-up comedy. And Michael Wyman from Nashville, Tennessee. And York Underwood, former local headliner, who decided to spread his wings. You know, some people want to spread their wings, you know, fly, grow, get out of Saskatchewan. Some people go to Alberta. Some people go to BC. He went to Reykjavik, Iceland. Not sure why. Maybe it was to start up the Bjork fan club. Maybe he's a secret Bjork fan. We don't know. But we're trying to get him on the show. He wants to be on the show. But we're trying to get him on and find out about York, because he's creating quite the comedy empire in Reykjavik, Iceland. Yeah. Anyhow, this week's guest is based out of Chicago, Illinois. And his name is Zach Purcell. He is a voiceover artist, stage actor, and a comedy musician. He does some things with a roll of toilet paper and the Rubik's Cube that I don't quite understand, but I guess that's okay. And best part is, the station was telling me when we were going back and forth talking about the show, they said, okay, if you want to do a spoken word show, you have to make sure that the guest talks more than you. Sometimes, if you followed the show, you'll know sometimes that's a little hard to do. Sometimes it's maybe 50-50, 60-40. But there's once in a blue moon where you get a guest that just loves to talk and won't stop talking, which is Zach Purcell. Which is great, because once the interview starts, I can go sit back, relax, and savor my Chinese food, which is okay. So, without further ado, from Chicago, Illinois, here is the one and only Zach Purcell, and we will be back at the end of the interview to tell you a few things that you should know and tell you about next week. So let's go and get this party started with the one and only Zach Purcell on the stand-up sit-down on CFCR, Saskatoon's community radio station.
Zach Purcell resides in Chicago and lives in what was voted the most dangerous neighborhood in America. He is a multifaceted performer as a stage actor, voiceover artist, and comedy magician. His voiceover talents can be found on Fiverr.com, and you can hire Zach to voice your next project for less than feeding a family of four at a fast food restaurant. His voiceover talents include an authentic Yoda, corporate training videos, and radio countdown shows. As a comedy magician, he performs for a variety of audiences, from corporate events to Christmas parties and even the birthday party for six-year-olds. He's won the Loyalty Award in addition to a Gigmasters Best of Award winner for 2012 and 2013 and being named Thumbtack's Best of 2015. It almost makes you wonder why he holds on to past glories. He also does things with a Rubik's Cube and toilet paper that are hard to believe. It's time to find out how Zach uses humor to make a living in our Humor at Work series, part three. Zach, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Was that how accurate was my Facebook stalking? Was that intro fairly accurate?
That was fairly accurate. It's pretty good. I don't actually reside in Chicago. I'm just outside of the Chicago suburbs in a city called Rockford, which is much smaller than Chicago, but I think the crime rate per capita, they say is about up there or maybe even higher. So it's a pretty, pretty crazy city here sometimes, but.
Okay. So then what's the population of Rockford?
We're at about 150,000 somewhere. Okay. I haven't checked in a while, but I think it's right around there.
Okay. So what exactly is Gigmasters and Thumbtacks?
Gigmasters and Thumbtack. And they are websites that kind of work. Well, you mentioned Fiverr. That's one of the ways I get work on voiceover. Gigmasters and Thumbtack are similar to that, but that's what I use for booking magic shows. So they're basically just places where people go that are looking for a magician and they want to get a quote for a show. Hmm. They type in what their event is, what they're looking for, and then me and a bunch of other people go on there and bid on those jobs and see who can win the jobs. And so those are.
So it's kind of like Fiverr, although it's magic based.
Yes. Yeah. And with Gigmasters and Thumbtack, and there's other ones like Gig Salad, they're not just magic based. They, you can book, if you're like a band, ventriloquist, juggler, just pretty much any type of hired out entertainment, you can book through those sites.
Okay. So you can pimp yourself out online legally. That's awesome.
Yes. Yes.
So
great thing about it.
So how did Rockford get to be voted the most dangerous neighborhood in America? You mentioned that, we were supposed to have a bit of a chat one day, and you said that you were caught in a traffic jam that was caused by a police blockade.
Yeah, that's right. That day, when we were in contact, I was actually on my way home. I have a day job too. I was on my way home from that. And
Can you say what your day job is?
Sure. I work at an assembly plant. I manufacture, vehicles basically.
Okay.
So that's, yep. All and, right. Jeep Cherokees, in fact.
Okay.
So, I was on my way home from that, driving down one of the main arteries in town, and I saw a police car. I had my wife on speakerphone, just talking to her on the way home, and in the opposite direction, a police car comes down, and then another police car, and I mean, full blast sirens and flying down the road, and then another. And I turned around because I'm like, well, what's going on here? This is crazy because this isn't an area of town where things like this usually happen, where you see a big police presence. So I did a U-turn, and I went into a parking lot near where they were going, and I saw these people running away from a bank. And I didn't realize, I had kind of forgotten there was a little bank right there on the corner of the street. And these people were running away from it, and I saw a cop. It looked like the police officer was chasing the people, but he was actually evacuating the bank because it was being robbed. And as I sat there, I saw more police cars come by, fly into that parking lot than I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, it was pretty much the entire, it had to be at least the Rockford Police Department. It was insane. And I come to find out later, this actually made world news, not just national news. This event actually was, people from other countries were saying that they had heard about this and posting clips on Facebook about it. There was a guy that, there were a few different versions of the story, as there always is with the media, but somebody was apparently went into the bank and didn't rob the bank, but apparently he knew one of the people that worked there was an ex of his. And that's all I really know for sure. The police say there was possibly sexual assault involved in this bank. At the time it was evacuated, it was just the two of them. But it was a standoff that went on for, I think, like 7 hours or something. But wow. They peacefully got him out of there and arrested him. And this guy had numerous warrants out on him and everything. So it was a pretty crazy day. But
yeah. So how did Rockford end up getting voted the most dangerous neighborhood in America?
Yeah, typically what it is it's shootings. We have a pretty bad gang problem, you know, street gang problem in Rockford, and always have for as long as I can remember. And to me, you know, I grew up on the side of town that's typically known as the rough side of town. And
so you've been in Rockford all your life then?
I've been in Rockford all my life, and I'm 44 years old now. And it wasn't really where I grew up. It wasn't really the roughest part of town, but it was the west side of town, the northwest side. And it's usually the southwest side. The schools that I went to, you know, especially in junior high and high school, you know, they were the schools that typically were known as the schools that the gang members went to and everything. And to me, it was just kind of interesting. I never had an issue because I've been doing magic since I was a kid. I started doing it semi-professionally when I was about 11 years old. And at the school, whenever I would show other kids magic tricks, a lot of people, especially these kids who were members of gangs, they would freak out because a lot of them thought it was real magic. You know, they didn't realize it was just tricks. And they would say to me things like, oh, wow, you know, and to other people, don't mess with this guy. This guy's got sorcery. He can, we're on your side. You know, they would always say they had my back. So I would have, you know, there's two rival gangs in town, and they would both say that they had my back if anybody ever bothered me because they were afraid of me. And so it was kind of a nice benefit to have that.
Yeah. And you also mentioned that Chicago will be like Saskatchewan and they won't be moving their clocks forward and back this year?
Yeah, apparently in Illinois here, from what I'm hearing, we're actually going to get rid of that whole daylight savings time thing, and we've been begging for that for the longest time. Now, where I live in Rockford, we border with Wisconsin. But Wisconsin is not changing that, so it might be a little confusing. But apparently we're going to keep our clocks the same, so I'm hoping that's the case because daylight savings time, the whole changing the clocks, I think it's staying on daylight savings time, it's just kind of a annoyance and a pain, you know.
Yeah, because there's a city in Saskatchewan that's called Lloydminster, and it borders Saskatchewan and Alberta. And Saskatchewan is the only province in Canada that doesn't change their clock. So on the Saskatchewan side, you don't change your clocks, but on the Alberta side of Lloydminster, you do.
Ah, yes.
And Alberta doesn't pay, Alberta doesn't have sales tax, but Saskatchewan does. So depending on which side of the border you're on, shopping can be a little bit cheaper.
Oh, wow. Okay. So yeah, that's different. See, in Wisconsin, they have a lower sales tax. Just about everything is cheaper in Wisconsin, I think. But it's not really worth it to go over the border just to buy something. But I could see if there's no sales tax on the other side of where you are, then that'd be kind of nice.
Yeah. And you say that you had a brown Christmas or not that much snow up until recently.
Right. This winter's been strange. In October, it was Halloween. The temperatures dropped and we had a pretty nasty snowfall. We had a big snowstorm. So through Halloween, we had nasty weather and then it cleared up And all through November and December, we just had nothing. I mean, it was just like, that's
around Christmas.
Yeah, right. And Christmas was completely dry, which is very, very strange for where we are in near Chicago. Because, you know, near Chicago, Chicago's known as the Windy City. So it's usually a little colder, you know, in that area and around here than it is in other parts of the Midwest. But that was crazy. Yeah. But we got some snow recently and we're starting to get a little bit more. I guess we're supposed to get some tonight, too.
Okay. So how far from Chicago is Rockford?
So I am, if you're talking about Chicago proper, like in the city, when I drive into Chicago, it takes me about an hour and 20 minutes. And if traffic's not good, I can do it a little quicker. My son is actually, he's 12 years old and he's going downtown Chicago for a field trip for school tomorrow. And they're taking a bus in. So I'm not sure. I would say with that, it would probably take about an hour and a half to get into the city. But wow. I go into the suburbs a lot. I do a lot of performances in the suburbs.
So. Yeah. Okay. Okay. Did you have any, do you have any brothers or sisters?
I do. I have an older brother and a younger sister. My brother is, I guess he's probably turning 50 this year. And I've got a sister that's just a couple years younger than me.
And are they both in Rockford or have they, spread their wings and?
You know, it's the interesting thing. My brother, he is in Rockford now. He spent 15 years out of the country though. Back in 2000, it's kind of an interesting story. He and a group of friends, decided that they, were going to move to Egypt. And, he actually moved out there, to teach English. Huh. At like prestigious sort of schools for ambassadors and stuff like that. And so he went out there and he did that for 15 years and he just came back about 5 years ago and has been living back in Rockford. My sister's mostly lived here. Her ex-husband was stationed in Camp Pendleton as a Marine out in California back, not probably right out of high school, but other than that, she's been pretty much back here. She just moved to a town about a half hour from Rockford, a little further away from Chicago, further west, called Freeport. But
does your brother is your brother teaching now?
He is not. Nope, he is not teaching anymore. He found out, you know, when he got there, he actually doesn't have a. He didn't go to school for teaching, but he found out that you can actually. Get a job teaching English in Egypt if you go there without a degree or anything like that. So,
right.
And, he always wanted to travel. He traveled to a couple of different parts of the Middle East and stuff too when he was out there. And, kind of a interesting thing that he did.
So what's he doing now?
Right now he works for the, U.S. Postal Service. He delivers mail.
Well, that's quite all right. So what was life? What was life like growing up in Rockford? Were you always the funny one, or did you get into magic as a kid as a way to counter bullies, or you just found that you really liked it and wanted to pursue it?
You know, it's a little bit of a combination of things. You know, when I was really young, 6-7 years old, and maybe, you know, just starting out in school, I was a little bit shy. Little awkward. And this is a kind of a similar story that a lot of people who get into magic have. And I didn't really know how to meet people and talk to people very well. So the first thing I did was I started to become the class clown, you know, and that got me into trouble because I was always cracking jokes and trying to make the other kids laugh. And of course, it's not always appropriate in the classroom. So I did get into a little bit of trouble with that. And then one day when I was probably about 8 years old, I was watching TV. I saw David Copperfield on TV. And if you know who David Copperfield is, he's the illusionist. And back then he made the Statue of Liberty disappear. And that was just, you know, the most amazing thing I had ever seen. And I decided after watching that TV special that I wanted to learn magic. And so I begged and begged my parents for a magic set. And that Christmas I ended up getting one. And I learned all the tricks in that. And I bothered my my family about every, I don't know, a couple nights every week, I would practice the same tricks over and over again. And I would make them come to my room and watch me put on a 20-minute show. And I had like a chest of drawers in a that had a cabinet in it. And I'd lock my little sister inside there and make her escape from it. And so I'd hold a curtain in front of it and she would escape. And it was pretty obvious how she did it. But I trained her to be my assistant. And, you know, and that kind of went on for a little while. And I sort of lost interest because I didn't have any other way to obtain any other tricks at the time. You know, there was no internet back then. This was in the early 80s,
right.
You know, and
yeah.
So I didn't really know what to do, and the props started falling apart because I worked with them so much. So then it wasn't until I was maybe about 10 or 11 years, about 10 years old, we moved, and I went to a different school right in the middle of the year, which was even more awkward because it was strange because I thought it was going to be a good move. I was nervous for a while, but then I thought it was going to be a good move because we ended up, I got to go before Christmas break to the school and tour it. The principal gave myself and my father a tour of the school, showed me where my classroom was going to be. And I looked through the window and some of the kids looked back and I thought, okay, it looks like it might be a decent class. So then when the next semester started and I was moved in and they brought me into the classroom early and I sat down at my desk and, I noticed when the bell rang, I could hear the kids out in the hall. They started to come into the classroom and the first girl opens up the door and she looks in the classroom and, she turns back around and I hear her scream out in the hall, "Hey, Shantae, we got that boy. We got that boy." And she sounded so excited. And I'm like, "Oh, wow, I'm going to be a real stud here at this school. All right." You know, and then I keep looking back and she turns back in and she looks back in the classroom and sees me again, turns back around. And then she says, "Oh, wait, never mind. That's not that boy. That's not that boy." So that was kind of the beginning of me knowing that it was going to be kind of a rough time at school. So getting to know people. But eventually a friend of mine that I had made, I saw him out at recess one day. Again, this was like fourth grade.
Yeah.
And he had this big crowd gathered around him and everybody was all excited about something. So I went through the crowd and I saw he had this little black box. It was just a little case that was a rectangle. And it was kind of flat and he had a playing card and he stuck the card in the box, closed it up, opened it back up and the card disappeared. And I had never seen that before. You know, wow, that's cool. How did you do that? You know, and the crowd dispersed and he said, "I can't tell you how I did it, but I can tell you where you can get one." So I thought, oh wow, what is this mysterious place that he got this amazing magic trick from? So I asked him what it was, where he got it. And he said, "Kmart." Okay, Kmart. Well, that's just an ordinary store. He said, "Yeah, in the toy section." So I went to, had my dad take me to Kmart, got this thing and I learned it. And then he told me the next day after I showed it, I had him, he said, "You know, there's a place where you can get a lot more stuff and you can learn a lot more things." And I said, "Well, where's that?" And he told me about a magic shop that was in town. It was called the Magic Manor. And I had a paper route at the time. I wanted to start working really young. I wanted to start making money and hustling one way or another. So I got this paper route when I was 11 years old. And I took the money and I had my dad take me out to this magic shop. And coincidentally, my dad knew exactly where the magic shop was because about a week prior, he had been there trying to sell the owner a sign for his shop. Because my parents moved to Rockford from Florida and back in 1974 because my father got a job working for a big corporation called Sunstrand Corporation in town. And that was the whole reason that they moved to Rockford. And he worked there for 13 years. And just a while before all this was going on, he got laid off after 13 years, just suddenly, surprised.
What's Sunstrand?
Sunstrand Corporation is a, they do, from what I recall, they do subcontracting, for, like U.S. military for jets and kind of like what Boeing does. Yeah, that sort of thing.
Okay.
Technology. Mm-hmm. So it was a big company, and he made good money. And my parents, they had just sold the house that I grew up in. And when we, this is why we moved, they bought this new house, and it was the biggest house in the neighborhood that we moved into. And right after he does this, he gets laid off from this job. So he was doing odd jobs, doing what he could, and he knew what this magic shop was. So he took me out there, and I started spending all my paper route money on props and learning how to do magic tricks and learning about presentation and all that stuff, because the owner also taught classes, and he would bring in lectures from all over the country and even different parts of the world. So that was kind of how it all began. And within a year, you know, before I was 12 years old, I think I was doing shows for birthday parties and nursing homes and that kind of thing. And it just kind of spiraled on from there.
Right. So in terms of magic, if you don't have the presentation down, then you don't really have any credibility, do you?
That's correct. Yeah. Presentation is essential, just like with any performing art. But especially, you know, it's definitely a big thing with magic. I mean, it's great if you can show a magic trick to somebody that fools them, but you learn really quickly that that's not what it's really all about when you see somebody who has no presentation skills. And it can take a long time to develop that. And it certainly took me a while to develop it. And I'm always, you know, I've been doing it over 30 years, and yeah, I'm always working at it. You know, I get video of all my performances, yeah, and I go back and watch as much of it as I can to see where I can improve and to find little mannerisms and things that I do that annoy the heck out of me when I watch it. So I'm sure it's, you know, annoys the audience, you know, so
yeah,
just little bits and things like that. As you know, as a comedian, I'm sure you do some of the same things.
I don't know what you're talking about. No, I'm kidding. So did the magician come first or the voice actor?
The magician came first. So here's the thing. The voiceover thing is interesting because it's kind of like this multifaceted sort of destiny that was coming at me from a bunch of different angles. And I was sort of accidentally deflecting it, because right around the same time I really got heavily into magic, shortly after that, I was about 12 years old, I had this funny thing happen. My parents took me to a local festival in downtown Rockford. It was called Beatty Is. And when I was there, there was a big semi-trailer that had been converted into what was called a showmobile. There was a local radio station. It's still around today. I've done some work for them. It was WZOK, and they were a top 40, you know, hit music station,
mm-hmm,
and still are. And they were doing a live remote broadcast from there. And I ended up just spending most of the evening watching them, being kind of entranced by this live remote and watching the DJs work. And afterwards, I went home, you know, the next night, I turned on the radio station, and because I had never really listened to radio much, I turned it on and I listened, and I was just kind of listening. I was interested in the DJ that had been doing the live remote the night before. I was listening to him work, and I was really fascinated with the work he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
So this went on for, you know, a couple of weeks. And then I found out he was leaving the station. He said he was announced he was moving somewhere, and somebody else was coming in to fill in for nights. And this guy came in to take over for nights, and he went by the name Rick Johnson on the radio. And his real name was Walter Flaccus. I found out later, because they had all radio personalities pretty much used different, you know, air names.
Right.
Names. Yeah. So I started calling the radio station every night and requesting songs, to the point where this guy, you know, recognized my voice. And kind of got to know me. And I decided at this point, you know, I had always heard if I wanted to do magic, that was what I wanted to do for a living. But I had always heard you need something to fall back on. You know, everybody always said that you need something to fall back on with whatever you're doing, if you're doing it working for yourself. So what I did was I decided if I was going to fall back on something, I wanted to get into radio. So I was in seventh grade and I had to do a report, a career report. So the teacher said you can just any career you want, but you have to be able to interview somebody that has that job. So I called Walter up one day and I asked him if I could come out to the studio and interview him. And he said, absolutely, no problem. You know, that I probably wouldn't be able to do that today. 12-year-old kid going to hang out in the radio studio.
Yeah.
Today. But so he let me come in. My dad dropped me off and went grocery shopping. And I hung out for an hour or so in the studio with this guy. And he was really cool, real nice. He showed me how everything worked in there and control board and all this stuff that they had back then, the carts and CDs and everything.
Yeah.
And I interviewed him and went through all that and had a good time doing it. And after that, you know, I continued to call him and he started having me, I would call and I would say, hey, you know, he liked to do these funny like skits on the radio. So I started doing like character voices for him and he would do a top 10 at 10 countdown, you know, the top 10 songs of the day.
Yeah.
Every night. And some, there would be nights where he would either have me come into the studio. My dad would drop me off again and I would do him there or I would do him on the phone and I would make up character voices for like five different, of the people that would, you know, he would have people call in to introduce the songs. Sometimes I'd be like three or four of these other, these people, sometimes five of
okay.
these people calling in and counting down these songs. And I thought, oh, this is kind of fun. He said, well, you know, voice acting is a thing and, you know, cartoons and stuff like that. There wasn't really much for video games back then, you know, but, so I said, yeah, that's kind of interesting. I said, but yeah, I want to be a DJ, you know, and he said, you know, being a DJ isn't really where the money is. And this is, again, this is in the early 90s at this point.
Right.
He said the real money is in voiceover and radio imaging, which back then was very true. You know, before Fiverr and pay-to-play sites and stuff like that,
yeah.
Voiceover artists made a lot of money.
The most popular one I can remember is Hal Douglas.
Oh yeah, yeah, and I'm sure Hal Douglas made a killing doing voiceover.
Oh yeah.
So he, you know, he said that's, but you know what? It was something. I was a kid then, you know, and there was no way I would even, you know, it was movie trailers and national commercials and that kind of thing. It wasn't even something that would have been on my mind at that time. You know, I'll go to college a little bit and I'll get into radio. So. That kind of blew by me. But as I got older and my voice matured, and I would go out and do shows, performances, I would have people come up to me after my shows quite often and say, hey, have you ever thought about doing voiceover? And, you know, I'd just kind of blow it off and be like, oh, yeah, I've heard of that. You know, I still had never really looked into what it was all about and what it all entailed.
What do you think made them suggest that?
Sometimes I would ask and they would say, you know, you have a unique kind of interesting voice. And I think some people were kind of surprised. People are often surprised to hear my voice. I've had friends tell me this all the time. Like when I first met you, you know, I didn't think that your voice would sound that way or even with the DJs. Cause I got to,
you don't look how you sound.
Exactly. I don't look how I sound.
Yeah, I get that. I used to get that when I was in radio. You don't look how you sound.
You don't look how you sound. Yes, it's very true. You know, I grew up up north here in as far as the U.S. goes, but in the Midwest. And my parents grew up in the South. And I grew up as a biracial child. So my father was black and my mother was white. And my father was very concerned with me and my siblings being raised and speaking properly and being able to get along well in society and not being looked down upon by, you know, and he was very proper, college educated and intelligent.
Right.
He was an accountant and everything.
Right.
And so I guess I just kind of took his teachings to heart. And so, but the interesting thing from that is I got that a lot. Like, yeah, you don't sound like you look, you know, it happened quite often. So I don't know. And I never really cared for my own voice, but you know, that Walter Flaccus, who I told you about, that was the DJ, he told me the same thing. You know, he said, I hate my own voice. And he sounded great on the radio. And he ended up getting out of radio for a while, just kind of a side note. He ended up becoming a rock star for a while. And is kind of getting back into that. He was actually the keyboard player for a 90s industrial rock band called Stabbing Westward. And they ended up getting signed after he left the radio station and toured the world and everything, which was pretty interesting. So I still kind of see him every once in a while. But that was kind of the way that went. But then it wasn't until later, gosh, I got my day job, the day job I told you about earlier.
Yeah.
I've been there for almost 10 years now, but I think it was 2014, I had been going through like some issues, getting headaches and stressed out a lot, because I had been through some really interesting times business-wise and personally. Like, for example, when I was about 14, I started working with somebody that I had met in middle school, a guy named Todd Ripplinger. We did a duo act, kind of like Penn and Teller or Roy kind of thing. We did that for about 10 years, and he ended up moving to Hawaii after about 10 years after college and everything, because he had a job with a friend of his doing what he went to school for. And we were very close. He was like a little brother to me. And you may have seen this on the website. He actually drowned in a surfing accident in 2003.
I didn't see that.
So he went missing. We didn't know what happened. I went with his family. It was in Maui. Went out there looking for him and everything, and eventually we found out that's what had happened. So I started doing performances solo again after that. And I ended up, you know, I started a family a couple years after that. I met my wife, who we dated for, well, we were together for a while. Then we moved in together and had our son. But I've been helping her raise her daughter. My stepdaughter's 20 now. She was 5 at the time.
Yeah.
And this was after I had gone through a divorce. And so after all this in 2014, I was kind of stressed out because I was working this day job and I really don't like my day job. But I needed, you know, here in the U.S., we've got this wonderful healthcare system that medical insurance is a challenge here.
Right.
So, and you pretty much have to work. If you're totally self-employed, it's very, very difficult. And work, you know, as a performer, work is not always steady. So we have our downtimes. So I ended up starting to see a therapist through work to kind of get through this stressful time that I was having. And one of the first meetings that we had together, she said to me the thing that I've been hearing people say for years. She said, you know, I don't think you're going to be happy doing any work for anybody else. You're only going to be happy if you're working for yourself. And if you need something to fall back on besides just magic, have you ever thought about going into voiceover? So I just kind of chuckled because I said, you know, people ask me that all the time. And so she said, you should look into it. She said, you know, people are doing it. You know, you don't have to drive into a big city and rent out a studio anymore. It's a whole different thing. What it used to, you can build a studio in your own home.
Yeah.
And so I kind of started to look into it, but I looked in the wrong places and I just saw a bunch of negativity. So it wasn't until actually just last year that a friend of mine who works, he's a magician, full-time professional magician. He's on national TV quite a bit, too. He lives in the Chicago suburbs. He was doing a regular seasonal performance that he does in the suburbs.
Right.
I went to see him, and he had mentioned that he had gotten an introduction done, which is something that I needed to have done, on Fiverr. And I had never heard of Fiverr and had no idea what it was. So I went and I looked up Fiverr because I thought, well, this is what I need for my show, because I hadn't had a updated professional introduction done, and I just had friends do it for me because right. I didn't think I could hire a voiceover for a reasonable price.
Right.
So, yeah, I found the website, and there was a big gap of time before I even looked into it. And when I finally did, I was amazed. You know, I was like, wow, you can actually hire some decent talent on here for a really good price.
Yeah.
And so I did. I hired two people on Fiverr to do introductions for my show, two separate ones. And I was amazed with the quality and for what I paid, especially.
Yeah.
And I thought, man, I can do this. So I decided to spend the next, months just absorbing all the information while I am at work, working on the assembly line. I can sit there with headphones in. So I was streaming YouTube videos and everything I could, absorbing all the information I could about how the voiceover industry works.
Wow.
And what it entails and what I would need to get started in it and everything. So yeah, wow. For probably about 3 months, that's what I did. I was working 10-hour shifts, almost 10 hours a day, absorbing video after video. And eventually I just decided to invest the money and put it all together, and I took off at the early last year, started doing it.
So you haven't been at it for, you haven't been at the voiceover part for very long, but, what sort of projects have you had through your agent or through Fiverr? What are some of the bigger, more notable ones?
Okay. So yeah, I haven't had anything huge. Actually, just today I got, I had a funny thing happen, but I'll tell you about that in a second. Through Fiverr, which is, like I say, where I started, I put together my demo, which I'm sure you've probably heard. I think that's how you found me.
Yeah, that is correct.
And I put that together myself because having a professionally done demo costs thousands of dollars, and I just couldn't afford to do that. So I learned how to do it myself. Not as good as the thousands of dollars ones, but I put it together. And when I started on Fiverr, I was actually pretty surprised. I started getting some pretty interesting things. It wasn't really anything big that I knew about, but I was doing some commercials for different ad agencies in different parts of the country and even in other parts of the world. I did a couple of small documentaries and things like that. And I started also marketing myself by sending out, emails making phone calls and sending out emails to people in production at like commercial production agencies and stuff. And I got a little bit of work there, and I got a hold of some people locally. I did some things locally for some people. So, I haven't really done anything huge. I haven't done any national ads or anything like that. I'm still working on that. The thing that surprised me the most was after only being in it for a couple of months and putting my demo together as sort of a joke to myself and to my wife, I sent my demo to an agent out in LA, and I just knew I was going to get laughed at, or I just wasn't going to hear anything. I didn't think I probably would have gotten laughed at, but never known about it. That's what
right.
I expected.
Right.
And the next day I got an email saying he wanted to represent me. And I was shocked because I totally didn't expect that to
normally,
happen.
Normally, don't you have to have some kind of credentials or whatever to get an agent? Is that unheard of to go in cold with no experience and say, hey, I'm new to this industry, would you like to represent me? Like, for an agent to take
right.
to take a chance on someone who's that new, is that sort of unheard of?
As far as I know, it's very, very rare, and that's why it surprised me so much. But I was surprised it happened. And, but now that's, that happened, but I haven't, and this is, this guy, he sends me auditions for national ads, big jobs, and I haven't landed any of it because there's a lot of people that are being not only represented, I'm sure, by him, but by other agents that are, getting these, offers to do these. It's like I'm still waiting, fingers crossed. I'm doing auditions. I do probably for him an average of one to two auditions a day through him, whereas there's pay-to-play sites where I'm getting about 10 to 15 auditions a day on there. And, I've just, and, you know, those are kind of hard to book too. I just finished, one recently, and I just, got today, which is kind of, this is the thing I was going to tell you, a funny coincidence that ties in with, the radio thing.
Right.
I got a message. There's a website called Voice123 that I, have a membership on. And it's one I have to pay for the membership, and I get all these auditions. And I got a message today from somebody saying, "Hey, are you a magician? If so, I think I remember you." And so I'm thinking, well, that's really strange, you know, because these are people from all over the world on here.
Right.
And so I'm a local magician, you know, I'm not known all over the world. I've performed in I've performed in Japan, Holland, and Egypt, but that's because I was there anyway. You know,
right.
For other reasons. So, but I still say that.
Right.
I responded and I said, yeah, I'm a magician. How do you remember me? And it turns out this guy used to work at that, WZOK radio station that, I was telling you about. And
hey,
I thought the name sounded familiar. So he said, hey, do you want to audition for a local, jewelry commercial we're doing? And I said, yeah, great. So I sent him a couple takes of this audition, and, fingers crossed, hopefully I'll get that gig, because it's probably the best commercial gig that, I will have gotten so far. So
that's cool. Now you have a voiceover studio in your house. I've seen, on your video, it shows the setup, but describe to us how it's set up, because it's not like a normal recording studio with a microphone and the mixing board. There's a lot more that you have to take into consideration.
Yeah, well, you know, since I just do voiceover, it's actually pretty simple. Because I'm in my booth right now, and there are a few different ways people do it. The way that I've got mine set up is I've got so my bedroom is an old finished attic. That's before I moved into this house, before I bought the house, it was an attic that somebody had finished before they flipped the house.
Right.
And so it's got vaulted ceilings, and then there's a area that's vaulted the other way, which should have a window to the front of the house, but it doesn't have a window. And that's actually a good thing for me in this case.
Right.
What I did was I used to use this for my office. I used to use this space for that. But I don't really need much of an office anymore. I used it for shows and all my booking and stuff. I don't do as much on paper anymore. It's pretty much digital and on my phone. So I moved my desk out beside this space. And what I ended up doing was I was actually kind of describing this to one of my coaches earlier today.
What kind of a coach?
Voiceover coach. Yep. So
now that's interesting that you bring that up, because I have a comedy coach that's based out of LA, and he's looking for the Tonight Show and all that stuff. And people would tell me, why do you need a coach? Either you've got it or you don't. Cause their thing was that you can't learn how to be funny. You can't go to school or have someone teach you how to be funny. Is that same mentality present in voiceovers?
No, you know, actually that's interesting. It's actually the total opposite in voiceover. In fact, pretty much everybody that I've heard from, learned from, in the industry. And I'm only actually coming at it from a certain angle here. This could be different where I'm not looking. But from almost everything, like I told you, with absorbing all these videos and all this content, and with voiceover, the pros pretty much always say, you need a coach, because
really, that is the complete opposite of comedy.
Wow.
Because the comedy coaches will say that if you're getting grief from other comedians about having a coach, that basically means the comedians are telling you that they don't want you to do well because it'll make them look bad.
Well, you know, that's entirely possible. I could see that. Yeah.
That's crazy.
I'm kind of skeptical minded when it comes to that kind of thing. So I could totally see that might be the case. I would probably take it that way too. Wow. But yeah, with voiceover, coaching is a huge thing. I can't recall anybody that I've talked to or learned anything from in voiceover saying, don't worry about getting a coach. They pretty much all say, because I mean, you can have more of an aptitude toward the industry or to what it takes, because some people are just more naturally inclined to be able to do certain things.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that those abilities can't be honed and shouldn't be honed and with help, you know?
Right.
So I definitely think coaching for just about anything, you know, could be a good thing.
Wow. That's insane. So describe the setup of your sound booth. Now, when I see the video, it looks like you've got some, I guess, foam walls that surround you. Is that the best way to describe it?
Yeah. So what I've got, it's interesting because there are a few different things you can use. The main wall.
Well, sorry to interrupt. What's the main consideration that you need to have present when you're constructing a sound room to do voiceovers? What do you have to keep in mind?
The most important thing, I think, and what most people believe, is your acoustics, your sound dampening. And the way, basically what that means is, pretty much all the way around me on all four sides.
Right.
The walls are, first of all, completely covered with, this is the sort of inexpensive way to do it.
Okay.
But it works really well.
Right.
They're covered with packing blankets. So that's the first thing I did, was I covered the walls with packing blankets, just like moving blankets. And I've got, these black and red moving blankets that are just all around. And then I also covered a large percentage of the walls, especially in the upper part where the upper part of me is, where my voice is coming from, with acoustic foam. So studio foam. And,
what does that do?
Okay. So what that does is when I talk in here, it absorbs, vibrations, the sound, different frequencies that I don't want reflecting off the walls and back into my microphone, making it sound like I'm in an open space or a tin can. It just basically allows my condenser microphone. And I'm not a tech guy. I've listened to a lot of stuff. I'm really not a tech guy. I don't know a whole lot about the tech. I just go by recommendations and
word.
But the condenser, the type of microphone I have is, I think it's a cardioid pattern. And what it does is it helps reduce the amount of reflection off the wall that comes back, because it only records from the front. But you want to dampen that as much as possible. So moving blankets and foam. And then I also built the walls in here. It's like a vaulted ceiling. Angles. So what I had to do is I had to build some straight walls that go down, straight down beside it. So to kind of shrink it up a little bit. So what I did was I got like, 2x4s, 1x4s, and I built these walls, and I took old, clothing and old pillows and just stuff that I had laying around that wasn't good enough to go to the Salvation Army.
Right.
And I just stuffed those into there, you know, and I put fabric, blankets on the outside of both sides of those. So I just made it as, I sit in a padded room basically. Without the jacket. And I use the jacket in the show. I escape from a straitjacket in my magic show, but I sit in a padded room when I do voiceover.
Okay.
So, yeah. So that's the, that part of it. And then of course there's the equipment, the hardware, which, you know, isn't as much as you would need for, like, you know, if you're doing a recording studio for a band or something like that.
Yeah. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, when you do voiceovers that are to be humorous, how do you know that it's going to work when you do it? Because it's not like you're on stage when you get that instant feedback. So how do you know when you, A, come up with the right words to use, and B, when you make it, when you have the sound that you want to make it funny.
Okay, well, you know, as far as voiceover goes, you know, it's going to be more about timing. You know, if it's a humorous voiceover, which honestly, I haven't really done a whole lot of comedic voiceover work, but when you do, it's, since I'm getting the script usually sent to me, I really just have to worry about my own timing. And then of course, I've got, usually when I get a job doing voiceover, I will send maybe two or three takes of what I've recorded, and I will, you know, just kind of go based off of feedback. And if something's not coming out right with the timing or whatever, I try to adjust it to, right, to make it work for whoever I'm putting it together for. And, you know, as you know, I try to send as many takes as I can and try to get things right whenever I can. And if I can't, I can't, but you know, I definitely give it a shot. So, yeah.
Right. So does that, because you're still fairly new to the voiceover game, if you do get something that's humorous or that's supposed to be, okay. So I should go back, I guess. So somebody won't come to you and say, I need a funny voiceover, and ask you to come up with the script. You'll always have one ready to go from the client, right?
And yeah, you know, I'm trying to think now if there's been any time where with voiceover where somebody has asked me to come up with a
because it was just trying to think that if you're still fairly new at it, it's kind of like being new in comedy. The first few times that you get up and do a show, you've got those, you know, the voices in your head that, you know, tell you a million different things that are wrong or that you could be doing better. So in your case, do those voices exist if you have like a humorous read or something? Because in today's world, you know, you don't really know. I mean, it almost seems like it's too politically correct, and I mean, something that's very innocuous and sincere could come across as is totally offensive. So when you're reading something and it has to be funny or have a humorous slant to it, do you still have those questions in your mind? Like, you know, am I doing this right? Am I going to get it right? What do I have to do?
Yeah, constantly. Whenever I'm reading anything, whether it's humorous or serious or whatever, I'll start reading something and sometimes I'll just stop mid-sentence and, okay, this sucks, you know, and I got to start all over. The nice thing about doing voiceover though is that I'm just, you know, I'm recording and I can just keep going and cut out, I can edit out whatever doesn't work, you know, whatever doesn't sound right, whatever doesn't make sense, you know, as far as my tone or, you know, how I'm saying something.
Yeah.
So it's really easy to edit. Of course, when we're performing and you're live in front of everybody, you know, it's a little bit more of a challenge because we can't go back and edit what we just did if we said something wrong or made a mistake or something came out wrong.
Yeah.
You know, so, there is that advantage there, which is kind of nice.
Yeah. Now, you describe yourself as a comedy magician. At what point did you decide to put the comedy element into your magic act, and how does it make a difference?
You know, that's a good question. It was a very gradual
my apologies, but I tend to come up with good questions when you're a single guy in your mid 40s with no kids and you live alone. So, you know, I got nothing but time. I got nothing but time to make a good impression.
There you go. There you go. It works. And I love questions. So as you can tell, I ramble on. I love answering questions.
Well, that's fine. Cause they told me at the station, well, if you're going to do a talk show or a spoken word show, then the guest has to speak more than you do. I'm okay. Like, okay, that should be easy.
Well, there you go.
So anyways, my apologies. So at what point did you decide to put the comedy element into your magic act, and how does it make a difference compared to watching somebody like a David Copperfield, for example?
Right, exactly. Well, that's what I was just going to say. David Copperfield, you know, growing up watching David Copperfield, and of course, back in those days, he was very serious and mysterious and dramatic and all that stuff. And he had a little bit of, you know, he had comic relief in his show, but
It landed him Claudia Schiffer.
Yeah, right, right. I remember those days too. Yeah. So he was, even though he had some comedy in his act, everybody in those days wanted to be like David Copperfield. And that was just the way it was. And even though I was a goofy guy, I was always joking around, cracking jokes. That thing really never worked for me. The dramatic thing, I couldn't be taken too seriously. And so I always kind of had and wanted to have the comedy element in my show. When I told you about my friend Todd earlier, when we worked together, we didn't really call it a comedy magic show, but that's what we were always striving for. And we weren't always funny. You know, we tried to be funny, but we always experimented with different things to try to make our show funnier. You know, we would do a thing I mentioned earlier. I do a straitjacket escape. He used to get in the straitjacket in the show, and I would sit down in a chair on stage, and we'd get a bunch of kids up and wrap us up in toilet paper, or wrap me up in toilet paper while he was in the straitjacket. And we would say, we're going to have a competition here. We're going to try to see who can escape first, whether I can escape from the toilet paper or he can escape from the straitjacket. Right. Obviously, the straitjacket's more difficult than ripping toilet paper off, but I pretended like that was difficult to do. And that automatically, you know, kind of was a funny thing. But then, in addition to that, I had the chair rigged up with a big old rusty steel file and a rusty hacksaw, and I would pull these things out and pretend like I was cutting the toilet paper in order to escape from it. And, you know, this would have people laughing, even though it was so obvious that it shouldn't be that difficult. And I guess that's maybe why it was funny. But we never really called it a comedy magic show. We just did it as a magic show. And then as I got older and realized I wasn't really going to, it wasn't going to work for me dancing around on stage with assistants, you know, showgirls and stuff, and doing the big stage illusions, because I tried doing that for a while.
Your wife probably wouldn't appreciate the showgirls anyways.
Yeah, she, you know, that, exactly. So my showgirls were my stepdaughter and my niece. That was it. And then once they outgrew the props, then, you know, I got sick of carrying these big boxes around and assembling them for hours before a show. I decided that I was going to pack my entire act in a couple of, you know, suitcase style tool cases, and pretty much whatever wouldn't fit in those wasn't going to go. And I would be able to throw everything in my sedan and drive around with it. And I started to discover that I was just leaning more toward the humorous magic more and more. And really, you know, one of my biggest inspirations over time had become, there's a guy who has a show out in Las Vegas. He's had a residency at Harrah's on the strip.
Carrot Top?
No, it's actually, it's, his name is Mac King. And,
I haven't heard of him.
Yeah, it's funny because he's got one of the longest running magic shows and one of the highest rated magic shows in Vegas. But a lot of times when you talk to people, they haven't heard of him. But people who have been to Vegas, and seen him, they remember him because he's got he's known as the funniest comedy magician to ever live. He's absolutely hilarious. Anybody listening, if you ever go to Vegas, I highly recommend seeing Matt King at Harrah's. Not only is he a hysterical and amazing magician, but he's also a really super nice guy. And I could tell you one of my favorite stories to tell other magicians, is about him. And, I've even told it to him many, many years later because of course I knew he would forget about it, but to me it was a big deal. You know, I started kind of emulating, kind of my show became more and more inspired by that style rather than, and I'm very different from him, but by more that style than David Copperfield, as much as I love David Copperfield's style. It just doesn't fit me. So, you know, he goes on a stage. He's got his own theater that seats hundreds. I don't know how many it is. And he comes out with basically a suitcase on stage and does card tricks and rope tricks out of a suitcase. And it's the most hilarious magic show you'll ever see. It's fantastic.
Wow.
So I just decided, you know, after a while, that I'm comedy magician, you know.
That's what I'm going to do. So what was the story that involved him?
Okay. So the story involving Matt King, this also involves my best friend Todd I mentioned before. This was back in 1998. I was 20 years old, I guess. How old was I? I'm sorry, 1996. I was just months away from being 20 years old. Todd, I think, was 18. And there was a convention going on in Las Vegas, and I had never been to Vegas at this point. And it's called the SAM Convention, the Society of American Magicians. I wanted to go. I was broke at the time, but Todd really wanted to go. And his dad really wanted to go too. And his dad kind of like was our tour guy. He would help us out with a lot of stuff and get us bookings. My dad did too. You know, they were very encouraging for us in doing this, which was a benefit that a lot of magicians don't have. A lot of magicians, and I'm sure comedians too, have parents that are like, "Get a real job. This isn't a real thing. You can't do this."
Don't even start.
Yeah, I know. I'm sure. So, thing is, it was going to cost money to go to this convention. I didn't really have the money, so I was saving. Finally, I got the money to go to the convention. Todd calls to the Society of American Magicians to book us a spot. And by the time he calls, they said, "Oh, we're sorry. We just sold out. We're completely booked up. Nobody else can join the convention." So we're like, "Oh, bummer." So we decided we're just going to go to Vegas anyway. The convention was at Bally's on the Strip, and we're going to stay at Bally's, and because we were able to get a room there still. And that's what we're just going to hang out during the convention, roam Vegas, see some shows, and hopefully this is, you know, it's a huge convention. So all the big names in magic were going to be there. So we go out there and we get to our hotel room. And, we, you know, it's the three of us, his dad and he and I, we check into the hotel room and then we decide we're just going to go down and walk around. So we leave the hotel room and we, get to the elevator hall, and Todd realizes he left his wallet in the room. So he runs back to the room. So his dad and I are just standing there waiting, and around the corner comes walking Matt King. Now, at this time, in the mid-90s, Matt King was most known for, there was a show, a TV show on during that time in the 90s. This was kind of after David Copperfield stopped doing his annual specials. It was called The World's Greatest Magic. They'd have magicians from all over the world perform on this, like, two-hour television special. And Matt King was the only one that was on all of the TV specials because he did a thing called the Matt King School of Magic. He's this really dorky, geeky looking guy that wears a plaid suit, and he would stand outside of at one of the swimming pools at one of the Vegas hotels, surrounded by beautiful women in bikinis, and he would teach them magic tricks, and they would act like they were all over him. And it was just this big funny thing because that wouldn't really happen. So I was a fan of his from that, and I knew him from that mostly. So when he came around the corner, I just kind of stopped in my tracks because this was the first magician I knew of that we saw. I said, "Oh, hey, Matt King." And he said, "Oh, hey," you know, and I said, "Oh, you don't know me. I'm just a fan of yours." And, and he said, "Oh, are you here for the convention?" And I said, "Well," so I told him the story, how we were, but we weren't. And by that time, Todd comes walking around the corner with his wallet and, "Hey, Todd, look who I bumped into, Matt King." And, so he was excited too. And so we got in the elevator and we talked, you know, just talked a little bit. And, he said, "Oh, you know, it's a bummer that you're not here for the convention, but, that kind of stinks. So we ended up parting ways. We went off. We did our thing. We did, we saw some shows. We saw other magicians walking around. We saw Penn and Teller walking around, you know, and a few other people that, magicians know you probably wouldn't have heard of. But, then the last day of the convention on the Sunday morning, we were heading back up to our hotel room, and we went to that, that same elevator area, and Matt King comes walking around the corner again, and he says, hey guys, I was actually hoping I'd bump into you guys. And we said, really? Well, why is that? We were kind of surprised, like didn't even think he would have remembered us, you know. And he said, well, because the big final show for the convention is going on at the Jubilee Theater tonight, and I have a ticket for it, but I can't go, something came up. And he said, so I have an idea. So I said, okay, well, what's your idea? He said, well, do you know who Daryl is? And we said, yeah, there was a magician. He's passed away, a few years ago, but he was a very well-known comedy magician by the name, he just went by the name of Daryl. And, we said, yeah, we know who Daryl is. He said, well, he's going to be in the room there at a table. There's going to be an extra chair there. He said, what you guys can do is one of you take my ticket. Walk into the theater with the ticket, go up to Daryl, he knows what's going on, he'll give you his ticket stub, walk out of the theater, hand the other guy the ticket stub, and then you can sneak the other guy into the theater. And so, and it's just kind of funny because Matt King, the School of Magic, a lot of what he does, he's friends with Penn and Teller, so a lot of what they do is, you know, pulling scams, you know, magical scams on people, you know. So I'm like, wow, we're in on one of Matt King's scams for real here. So we said, well, really? Okay, well, this is great. So he hands us the ticket, and we decide Todd's going to be the one to give this a shot. So that night, we are standing outside the Jubilee Theater, and Todd walks in, gets his ticket, Torin walks in, and I'm standing there waiting, and I'm nervous because, you know, I said I'm a few months away from being 21, and I had already gotten kicked out of, like, 3 or 4 casinos for hitting the slot machines and getting carded. So it's got to be 21 to do that.
Okay.
So finally, a few minutes later, Todd comes walking out with a straight look on his face. My heart's pounding because I think I'm going to get kicked out of this casino for the second time after trying to pull the scam.
Right.
And all of a sudden, he's got a big smile on his face, and he pulls out the other ticket, and he hands it to me. He's like, we're in. So, yeah, so Matt King scammed us into getting in to see the final show of a convention we weren't even part of, technically. So that was that was just a really cool kind of fun thing to have happen for a couple of young magicians that,
No kidding. Now, for a comedian, they can have a rough start to their show if they aren't believable or if the audience doesn't like them. Is there a situation where the audience won't be receptive to a magician at the start? Is there such a thing as having a magician bombing? And if so, how do they try and win the audience back?
Oh yeah. You know, in fact, this happened to me actually recently. A few weeks ago, I also do a mentalism act. So the act of
what exactly is that? Like Kreskin?
Basically. Kreskin. I like to, as I say in my show, I like to briefly simplify the definition of mentalism by saying that it's the act of reading, controlling minds, and predicting stuff. And controlling minds and predicting stuff. And it's just an act, but we make it look as real as possible.
Right. So what kind of a show was it? Was it a corporate show or?
Yes, it was a corporate show. It was for an airport, like the staff of a small airport. And I actually hadn't done my mentalism show for a little while, and I had implemented some new things, and I was rehearsing it, and I was feeling pretty comfortable, pretty confident about doing this. And I had had several conversations with the client on the phone ahead of time, and she was kind of nervous. She had a lot of questions because they hadn't really hired that type of entertainment before. And when I got there, there ended up being quite a few more people than I expected, which is good for me usually because I, you know, a lot of people say they don't share this this feeling. But for me, the bigger the audience, the better in most cases, unless it gets too big to where they can't see what I'm doing. But they had about 140 people. I think they were expecting about 100 people. And so I was up on a stage. It was a nice room and everything. And they had a few, they had some tables set up in front of the stage. So the owners of the airport and mostly like their closest family and friends sat there. And then the rest of it was standing room only. And I started the show, and the very first thing that I did in the show, I flubbed it a little bit. The first mentalism trick, I flubbed it a little bit. When I had reset it after my last rehearsal, I think I reset it wrong and it kind of goofed up.
Now, how do you mean reset it?
Okay. So yeah, basically what it is, what the routine was I was telling a brief story about explaining, like I just did, what mentalism was, because most people don't know even when they're about to watch my show. So I said, you know, the first time I ever saw mentalism, I was, you know, about 9 years old, and I was at my grandparents' house, and he came up to me with a handkerchief over his hand. So I have a handkerchief over my hand at that point. And I said, he asked me, he said, go ahead and shoot me a number between 1 and 5. And so I said, and then I asked somebody in the audience to do it. So they say 3, so or whatever they say. And I take the handkerchief off my hand, and I'm holding up that many fingers. And so it gets kind of a chuckle. And I say, that wasn't my grandpa's worst joke, but it, yeah, actually probably was my grandpa's worst joke. And I said, but he says he likes magic. He said, I like magic. So he puts the handkerchief back over his hand, and I do the same thing, and I take it off, and there's a card folded into quarters. And I end up basically asking them to name a card. And when I unfold that card, it's the card that they named. I was off by one. And I wasn't supposed to be. And, being off by one, I think they said like the 3 of hearts. And I think I had the 2 of hearts or something like that.
There's 52 cards in a deck, right?
Right.
So how were you able, like, that almost seems, I don't want to say impossible because you can do it, but it just trying to think about it from an outsider's point of view, it seems almost impossible to do, to be able to go through those cards and come up with the right one. Or is that not explaining it right?
Yeah, no, that's the funny thing about magic is I always tell people, you know, because magic and mentalism are really the same thing. It's, they're tricks that are made to either look like visual magic or magic of the mind, which is mentalism. And the funny thing about it, I tell people, and sometimes they don't believe me, I say, you know, you really don't want to know how this stuff works, because when you do, it's kind of disappointing, because the secrets, you can think about something all day, like, how is that even possible? But then if I tell you how it actually works, then you're like, oh, that's really stupid. I should have figured that out. You know, it's kind of dumb, but a lot of the secrets are kind of like that, where they just are disappointing when you find out. But that one, that particular one is kind of interesting, because it's, after being in magic for decades, it's hard to be fooled by anything. It's very rare that I see something that fools me.
Right.
And so, but this trick, when the person who taught it to me showed it to me a couple of years ago, I was fooled by it. And I kind of knew the basic idea, but I was still fooled by it.
So when it doesn't, okay, so you're at a show with 140 people, and that the first trick didn't go over. How do you win the audience back to establish that credibility, that relationship again?
Right. So
were you able to?
I with part of the audience. That was a rough night, because what happened, right after that happened, I knew immediately I have to try to come up with an out, recover. So what I did was, whatever the card, you know, the person said 3 of hearts, I immediately grabbed a deck of cards that I was going to use later. And I said, okay, I was off by one, but that's because we didn't use the entire deck. That has nothing to do with it. I just made something up to make it sound good. Right. And then I had them pick a card out of the deck, and immediately I made sure that, you know, there's a way magicians can make you. I could spread out a deck of cards and make you pick whatever card I want you to. So that's what I did. I said, go ahead and take a card, and then they ended up picking the Three of Hearts. And then I got the reaction from that I was looking for. So it kind of made it look like I did that on purpose.
Right.
But even though a lot of the audience was convinced I had done that on purpose, I kind of broke rule number one, and I kind of let it get to me, let it affect me that I had screwed that up. And all my nervous tics started kicking in because I knew there was going to be more stuff in the show that I hadn't done for a while that I was already kind of nervous about because it was my mentalism show and I don't do it nearly as often. I had a bottle of water and my mouth started getting really dry really fast and I started getting a little more nervous. And fortunately, as I went on, I think things were pretty good as far as what I was doing technically. But what happened was the back half of the room, where I would say probably almost two-thirds of the crowd was, I don't think I got them back because they just started talking amongst themselves. They started talking and talking, and that became a distraction not only for me but for the audience that was really into the show, the whole front half of the room that was into it and enjoying it. And it got to the point where my client actually she got up and she walked. I thought she had to go to the restroom, and I found out later what had happened. She got up, she walked out to the back of the room, and then she came back a few minutes later. And that's what I thought had happened. She went to the restroom, no big deal, whatever.
Right.
So I I get through the rest of the show, and after the show, because I would say for 90% of the show, there was a large group of people just talking, not paying attention. And I tried to get them back. And there were even some people in the front of the crowd that were like, hey, shut up back there, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
They were just being rude, you know, being really rude. Right. So, which is really unusual. Every once in a while, I'll get a couple people that are in the back talking or whatever. But this was like a lot of people.
Right.
So it threw me off. So after the show, she comes up to me and she apologizes profusely. I am so sorry. This is BS. You know, she said, I don't know how language you've done show, but she said, I am very sorry. I cannot believe my employees and their spouses were this rude to you. This is ridiculous. Your show was wonderful. I don't know how to explain this. She said, I ended up leaving. I had to go out into the back room and talk to one of my managers to find out if there's something if we should pause the show to shut everybody up or what. She said, I almost started crying because I was so upset, you know, because they paid me a decent amount of money to be there to entertain these people.
Right.
And so that was one time where, you know what, I would say I only recovered about a third of the audience. And that was very recently. There have been other times where I just, you know, had a rough crowd at the beginning and I was able to, I try as hard as I can to just make my show intimate and lock onto them. And, you know, a lot of my show, one of the benefits I have is I have audience participation in my show.
Right. So, do you ever get hecklers?
Every once in a while.
Oh, really? And in a magic show, what would the heckling entail? What would they say?
Gosh, you know, I'm trying to think. The last time I had a heckler.
Or it's been what? Quite a while. I guess what? Why would an audience heckle during a magic show? Was it because we talked about earlier how the presentation ties in to credibility? Are the hecklers maybe wanting to be a part of the show, or they just don't think that you're very credible, so they want to sort of take you to task on it?
You know, when it comes to hecklers like that, it's usually kids. You know.
Oh, really? That, so you got heckled at the 6-year-old show you performed at?
Yeah. Well, the 6-year-olds actually aren't so bad. 6, 7, 8. It's once you get into like 8, 9 and 10 year olds, boys especially, that they can be the toughest crowds. Honestly, I just today I booked a middle school that's at the end of the month, and I haven't performed for middle school kids in quite some time. So we'll see how that goes. That's a very rare one. But yeah, 9, 10 year olds, I do birthday parties. I do quite a few of those. A lot of magicians don't like doing birthday parties. Normally I love doing birthday parties. They're quick and easy, and, you know, so I have fun with them most of the time. But 9 and 10 year olds, they're at an age where they're skeptical. And they want to be the center of attention, and they don't want anybody else to take that away from them. So you go in front of a group of 10 or 15, 9 and 10 year olds, you're going to have at least 3 or 4 boys. And I'm seeing this more and more with girls at that age too, that are going to, just decide that nothing you do is going to fool them. And they're just going to start shouting out, you know, things that they think you did. Even if it's just totally way off, which 9 times out of 10 it is. And they want to interrupt the flow of the show and just yell at you. And nowadays, parents, they don't really do much about it. Parents, they don't tell their kids to settle down. They don't, you know, it's a different world. Doing it for so long.
So the kids are there. Sorry to interrupt. So the kids are there. In the same room with the parents. It's not like you're just performing for the kids because the parents are there as well, right?
Right. Most of the time, there are a few different ways it works. A lot of times, and especially with these older kids, a lot of times, you know, the kids just get dropped off at the birthday party. And so the only parents that are there are the birthday child's parents, of course, if it's at their house. Wow. Or there might be a few other parents. And so their hands are kind of tied in a lot of cases. A lot of them are afraid to say something to somebody else's kid. They don't really want to do it. So they'll just kind of see how I handle it.
Right.
And I can kind of understand that definitely. But, there are situations where, you know, sometimes the parents are there or the kid's parent is there and they won't do anything about it. I've even seen parents laugh. You know, that their kid was heckling me, you know.
So does that sort of environment dealing with those bratty, snotty kids, does that environment give you any tools to deal with the adults when they're acting out of tune?
Like, what do you mean?
Those kids, obviously, they're not, I mean, the kids, when they act out, would probably say and do things that probably adults would only do when they're drunk, maybe, because they don't have, you know what I mean? So dealing with kids in that kind of environment, when they're making it rough on you, how does that, or does it make you a better performer, where you have to maybe introduce some new things in your act or change some things so when you get to the bigger clients for adult crowds, you can navigate it a bit better?
Yeah, you know, it is. That's the way I look at it, as a learning experience. Anytime something like that happens, I think, well, what could I possibly do to either prevent that from happening or diffuse the situation, or, you know, make it, turn it around so that it's not so brutal. Like, you know, sometimes, like I say, the kids are just looking for attention. So what I'll do in sort of a roundabout way to make it kind of look like I don't like to make it look like I'm giving in to them and giving them what they want, but I do in such a way that, like, if I know from the beginning a kid is going to be an issue, what I'll do is I'll try to get them up to help me out with something right away. So that way they're less inclined to give me a hard time
because
during
they'll be
the
rest
nervous. Of the show. Mm-hmm. And that works pretty often. I've done that recently. I can think of a situation where a kid was just, as soon as I started the show, he's yap, yap, yapping and this and that. And I'm like, oh, this kid's going to want to be the center of attention. So I brought him up to do something that I don't even normally get somebody to come up and help me with, but I figured out a way to do that right then and there. And it's also gotten to the point where I, a lot of magicians say, you don't need to worry about doing a contract for a birthday party, for example. Because, I do contracts for corporate shows, bigger shows, whatever.
Right.
But for birthday parties, they say some parents might be put off if you send them a contract. And I do a system through my website. What I do is I send out an email that basically has the contract information in it, and they click on a link, and then they can fill out all the information on my website and then submit it, and then boom, everything is taken care of. So instead of calling it a contract for birthday parties, I had a birthday mom a while ago that put together an intro for my show. Basically, she had seen a magician at a birthday party before that, and it was a rough crowd. And so she didn't want that to happen at her kid's birthday party. So she put together this intro and told the kids, there's going to be times in the show where you're going to want to make noise and clap and yell and scream and, all that kind of stuff. Right. And I even told her, but there's also going to be times where you need to sit and listen and pay attention to what the magician is saying. And,
right.
And so I ended up taking this intro she gave me and adapting it to different shows that I do. So now I just send that in an email. When I book a performance, I say, hey, if you want to, this is optional, but if you want to, you can do something like this intro or something similar to this to kind of let the kids know what the deal is.
Kind of like a disclaimer.
Yeah, a little disclaimer kind of thing. And also, there are certain things. Like in my kids' show, I use a dove. I have a live dove in my show. And I've had situations where, dogs and cats will sniff out my dove. And I even had a golden retriever eat a parakeet that I was going to use in a show. The next day, it was my next door neighbor's. I was training with it outside, and it flew right into his mouth when I was a kid.
That's crazy. Wow.
Yeah.
So you've been on stage with a dove, and there's been like a dog or whatever or it's some animal that sniffed it out?
Yeah, they'll sniff it out. Like I have a dove that hides before the show, and it appears, depending on the show, either at the beginning or the end of the show. But it's hiding somewhere on stage, and nobody knows it's there. In the living room if I'm doing a birthday party. And if they've got dogs and cats running out around, inevitably they usually will sniff it out.
Uh-oh.
Stand there. Yeah, and it makes me nervous. So I put in there, if you have dogs, if you could just put them in another room, that'd be great. And people are really good about this. I just did a birthday party a few weeks ago where the lady, she said they had two dogs, and they boarded them for that day. They got them out of the house, and she went over every detail of the contract and everything. And
I would imagine that cats would be more inclined to maybe have the doves for lunch as opposed to the dogs. The dogs maybe want to play with them a little bit more. So I would I would be nervous if the cats were sniffing them out.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So when the animals sniff out the doves, does that create – a distraction that the other kids or the mums in the audience pick up on?
Yeah, it creates a distraction. I don't know if there's ever been a time where somebody has said, oh, wait, what's going on here? Do you have like some kind of animal or anything like
that? How do you get past that when there's a distraction that's taking away from your performance?
Usually what I'll do is I'll just kind of make it known to whoever. Like if it's a dog situation, they'll eventually know. Usually they'll be like, hey, get away from his stuff. Sometimes they don't, but they'll tell the dog to get away from his stuff. And then I'll take them aside and say, hey, I don't want the kids to know this, but I've got a, my dove is hiding here. And this is, I lost a bird to a dog once. So, and then they're always like, oh, okay. Yeah. Here, we'll lock the dog up. No big deal. I have to let them know. I like that to be a surprise, but I also put it in my promotional material, that I make this live dove appear, but sometimes I just have to let some people know so nothing bad happens.
Wow, that's crazy. Wow. Yeah. So in our last few moments here, what are your goals for 2020, what do you hope to accomplish? And with your voiceover work specifically, what's the end game?
I'm still working on my 2020 goals for voiceover. This possible job that I got today, I think would be a really good deal for me. I'll find out tomorrow.
I imagine that you want to get to a point where you can ditch the assembly line and just work for yourself full time.
Exactly. That's what I talk about at work all the time, and everybody that I work with knows that. they're all like, "Oh, there's Zach. He's gonna get out of here someday. He wants to get out of here." And a lot of them have booked me for work and everything too.
So you've been with your wife now for how many years?
About 14 now.
Okay, so at this point, you said that you're 44, and
yep.
Is it tough for, do you think it's tough for her to have faith knowing that you're going to eventually achieve that and become completely self-supporting as you start to get up there in age? Because I think the mindset would be different when you're 44 as opposed to in your 30s.
Right, right. Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like with her, and we talk about it a little bit. She's just very, very supportive and trusting in what I want to do. And she knows that I'm not going to do anything rash and drop my day job before I'm ready. And she's actually been a stay-at-home mom, since she was pregnant with our son. And he's 12 now. So, you know, we've talked about the possibility of, you know, if she finds a good steady job that's got health insurance and everything, that would make it a lot easier for me to take off and do what I need to do. But
you have health insurance with the assembly plant, right?
Right, right. Yes.
Okay.
I do.
Okay.
And it's good health insurance.
Right.
You know, it's really good health insurance. Okay. And that's really the, that's one of the major things that's keeping me there. It's
right.
It's because I have some of the best health benefits that you can find in the country with the
right.
job that I have.
Right, right.
Yeah. So we always say it's a trap. You know, they've got us trapped in there because of that.
Yeah.
And it's a good hourly wage too. You know, it's decent money and everything. You know, but would I be willing to take a pay cut to do what I love to do? Yeah. But it's scary. And I know people who have done it. And there's a guy that used to work the same place I work, and I've talked to him. He's given me some advice, but he left, several years ago and went into voiceover full time. And he's doing that. And he's the voice for the UFC now. He does all the commercials for the UFC. And he used to work at the same plant that I work at.
Wow.
A real nice guy. But, yeah, so I know it's going to take time. Basically, the goal that I've set kind of medium term is every 4 years we have a contract, a union contract, because I'm part of a union working
yep.
out there. And we just went through the contract process. And so we've got another one in 4 years. And after that 4 years, I will have been there for about 15 years. So my thing that I've been saying lately is, if I'm not financially secure with between the magic and the voiceover to leave by that time in the next 4 years, then I'm probably going to be stuck there till I retire. So that's kind of my goal right now. I'm hoping that it works out and that I'm able to do that. And who knows what'll happen as far as healthcare system in this country, you know, over the next few years. We got
yeah.
the election coming
yeah.
up and all this stuff. So yeah, it could get better. It could get worse. Who knows?
Yeah. Know? Well, later this fall, I think we've got a federal and a provincial election a provincial and a city election that happen in the span of probably 60 days. So.
Okay. Okay. Wow.
So I know what I know all about elections and how much fun that they are. But in our closing moments here, if people want to get a hold of you for, you know, voiceover work or find out more about your, you know, comedy magic and that sort of stuff, where can they look you up?
All right. Well, you can actually find me for both things at the same place. If you go to www.tnz, so that's like Todd, Nancy, Zach, magic.com, that's my magic website. And then my, I actually have a voiceover dedicated website being worked on right now. But as of right now, my voiceover page is on that site. So you can just kind of click on the things that I do and it'll pop up in the list, voiceover. And it's got my demos and some of my sample projects. And
on the magic site.
On the magic site right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Do you have any, have you ever been to Canada or any experience with Canadians in general or?
I've never actually been to Canada. This past summer, I saw Canada for the first time. I was in Detroit. My wife and I went to Detroit to visit friends from Canada. It's kind of interesting. Yeah, my wife met some people online. It was this woman and her husband. They live in, they're in Nova Scotia, I believe. She met them online after my son was born because our son, he was born with a rare medical condition called cranial synostosis, where he was born where one of the platelets, the left coronal platelet of his skull actually fused early. It's not supposed to fuse until you're in early childhood. But it fused before he was born. So his head was growing in an odd shape. And so he had to have two surgeries by the time he was 9 months old. So it was a rough time.
He's fine now, though.
He's fine now. Yeah, he's doing great now. But, you know, it was a pretty mild case of it. There are much, much more severe cases of it, but it's pretty rare. And so that's one of those things. We were going through a lot, you know, back then. That was a very, very tough time. So she was on a support group on Facebook on that. And she,
right.
She met some friends on there that she stayed in contact with over the years. So they were they wanted to come to the States and then visit. So we kind of met halfway. We met in Detroit. And
the safest place in the world.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because Detroit is Motor City. It's, you know, where the headquarters of the company I work for is at, Chrysler.
Yeah.
And I had always been like, you know, oh boy, afraid to go to Detroit. It sounds like the scariest place in the world from everything you hear. Even worse than Rockford, which is, you know, hard to imagine anything being worse than Rockford.
Yeah.
So, but a friend of mine that I had met at one of, probably the first friend I made at my day job, he was from Detroit originally and he moved back there a couple of years ago. And so we also visited him the first day we got there. We hung out with him and had dinner with him. And he showed us around town and he's like, you know, things have changed around here and it's not nearly as bad here in Detroit as it used to be. And it really wasn't. There were some really nice areas, but he took us to a park and he said, see the water here, right over the water, all those lights over there, that's Canada. Over there, oh, cool, I'd never seen Canada before. So and then we hung out with our friends from Canada, and so that's pretty much it. I mean, I used to have a business years ago that was a totally different business. I manufactured theatrical pyrotechnic special effects supplies for like rock bands and magicians and stuff. That's how I got into magic. And I had some guys, a magician from Canada, drive down and visit and pick some stuff up, but they didn't want to get a hotel room. So they stayed at the place where I was living at the time and just for the night and then drove back to Canada the next morning. So that was an interesting thing.
Okay. Interesting. So obviously people can find you on Fiverr.com under Zach Purcell, ZACKPERCELL. What are the other websites that you mentioned that are kind of like Fiverr but dedicated to voiceover or magic stuff where people can find you?
Right. Okay. So other than Fiverr for voiceover, I'm on voice123.com. So it's just the word voice, 123. And I have a profile on there, and I don't even really know what it looks like because I just go in there to do auditions. But it's got some information. I have there are some other ones that I don't really do anything, that I don't really do much through. Right. But as far as magic goes, yeah, gigmasters.com. You can find me there. Gigsalad.com. Thumbtack, I think, is a little harder to find me because you have to put in information before you can see anything. I think you're like own account information or whatever, I think. But, yeah, those are the main ones really. But yeah, mostly just my website, tnzmagic.com, is probably the best way to find me.
Well, very cool. Very cool. What have you thought of our time together? I hope you've enjoyed it, and I hope it's been worthwhile for you.
Oh, absolutely. I've loved it. This has been great. I, like you say, I enjoy answering questions. You had some great questions, so I've had a great time. It's been a lot of fun. I appreciate you doing this, and I've enjoyed it.
All right. Great. Thank you very much. And we hope to have you, when you make it really, really big and you become rich and famous, hopefully you'll remember us and come back for another chat.
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt. Hopefully that'll happen.
Okay. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
And that concludes our talk with Zach Purcell from Chicago, Illinois. We are back live with the stand-up sit-down on CFCR 90.5 FM in Saskatoon with Trevor Dean. We got the technical issues somewhat sorted out. And see, that's the beauty of live radio. Because like I said, I'll edit the show, put it on the website, probably, just because of the way my schedule works out, probably Saturday evening. And when somebody listens to it, they'll be like, oh my God, that's so awesome. And think that everything's just so slick and professionally done. And I'll be like, yeah, totally. Because that's what I always aim for, perfection. And, you know, like I said, live radio, it's sometimes like stand-up comedy. Sometimes things go smoothly 90% of the time. And once in a while, you hit a fork in the road, which keeps you on your toes, but that's okay. Anyways, thank you very much for being with us and sticking with us. Went a little bit longer than he usually does, but again, thank you very much. Don't forget that next week, it's Rachel Summer from Australia, who used to be in Winnipeg, Canada's funniest optometrist. And then the week after that, Steve Bluestein. And then after that, I have no idea. But we'll hopefully find out. This has been another edition of the Stand-Up Sit-Down on CFCR 90.5 FM. I'm the creator and host of the show, Trevor Dean. Thank you very much for listening. Until next week, leaving you with some summer madness and Cool in the Gang. Good night.